Hello everyone and welcome back to the Esports Roundtable podcast, where we discuss the past, present and future of all things business and esports. I'm your host, Joe Hills, the founder of Looking for Group, and today we are joined by James Grunke, the former global head of esports for Nvidia. James had a storied career in the world of music and entertainment before stepping into esports and served with Nvidia for over 7 years. He is in a fantastic position for us to mine down into his experience of how things have changed and grown from the endemic perspective. This episode will be focusing in on navigating the gap between non-endemic brands and endemic organizations and how we can promote collaboration and mutual gain so the industry can reach its potential in the future. We had one episode with Imari Oliver, formerly of WMEIMG, 2 weeks ago. That was speaking more from the brand perspective, and today we're going to be focusing in on the endemic expectations, how important these sponsors and actors have been in the industry so far, and also what we can do to improve their operations and stake in the industry in the future. James, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
So before we get started, we always like to take some time to understand a little bit more about you. So if you could take us through your story, your journey, how you got to where you are now, and your history as a gamer, that would be awesome.
So I've had a very fortunate career across digital media marketing in both and esports, video games, music, and movies. Started out, my first gig out of college was with Crosby, Stills and Nash. I was a concert piano tuner and an expert in digital audio and music technology, and went off on tour with them and did two tours with them over 2 years. And then they referred me to a job with Brother Records, which is the parent company for the Beach Boys. And I toured with the Beach Boys in the summer and worked in their studios in the winter. And I did that for 3 years. Fantastic experience. Used Atari computers there for our music and audio editing. And ran into them at Comdex 1 year and got them tickets to go backstage to the show. And they loved what I was doing. And they called me over to the trade show the next day and offered me a job. And I've been in Silicon Valley ever since. Worked on the computer line for a couple of years, and I moved over to the video game line, and I was director of audio for their titles on the Atari Jaguar. And I did about 12 titles with Atari and another half a dozen on my own. Moved over to the movie business with VM Labs and Roxio, and we had toolkits that we sold in the movie studios for them to do interactive content on their DVDs and Blu-rays. And so I managed our studio relations there. It was a great time. Got to know Hollywood a little bit. Fascinating business. And then around 2008, when we hit the economic skids, I had an opportunity in Nvidia, and I moved over there and worked on their CUDA software marketing with their partners for a while, for the first year and a half. Then I went into the esports thing, and our first tournament at Nvidia was a StarCraft II tournament, right when StarCraft II came out. And you know, we heard all the news that it was going off the hook in South Korea, and you know, all of our regions were talking about it, and the U.S. seemed to be probably the least excited, I think, from a media standpoint. So we decided to do a global StarCraft II tournament. And we announced it and opened it up to the public, and it went off the hook. Our registration servers went offline. You know, they crashed. I came in the next day, told my boss, "Hey, our servers crashed." And he goes, "Cool." So it was an interesting thing. And we had over 9,300 amateur players sign on, largest amateur tournament in the history of StarCraft II at that point. And we had 36 pro players, which we did. It was a pro-am, so we had the pro players casted by Husky in Day 9 and broadcast on the game station, and we had over 14 million views on the content. And management came back and said to me, let's do more of these, and been doing them ever since. So then after the StarCraft II thing, you know, that was our first experience. It was a great success, tough to follow up, but esports was – you know, gaining momentum, and we were hearing from it from all four corners of the earth. So we kept going. The next thing we did was the World of Tanks 100K Open. And again, this was global. It was in China, Russia, North America, South America, Europe. And again, it was a world record setting, registration from an amateur side. And it was an open, so there wasn't a separate pro side, but we ended up with five pro teams from around the world making it to the finals, which we held at PAX that year. And it was just a blast. We worked with ESS, which is now part of ESL, to produce that tournament. And it was fantastic. And the important thing for us there was helping the publisher with their content. And we moved that title from when we started that tournament at number 18 on Twitch to number 7 when we finished the tournament. And they weren't even ranked on the esports title tracking tours. And when we announced, they came out at number 9 on pro gaming tours. And number by the time we ended, they were number 4.
Very cool. I think from being there from the StarCraft days, growing with the industry and also being a resource and a partner to lean on has obviously been an important aspect of widening the commercial scene around esports. It's a bit of a no-brainer why these names like NVIDIA and Logitech that are largely taken for granted these days and other hardware companies would love to market and be active in this industry. But I also think that the scope of player salaries, the maturity of the organizations themselves, and the events would probably be much, much smaller if it weren't for these early adopter organizations that saw the potential in esports and have helped nurture it over the last few years. Let's move on from your background slightly and let's talk about endemic brand expectations in esports and how those have changed over the last 5 years. From your perspective, what would have been the highlights of how the industry has matured so far, perhaps not in a positive way?
Well, yeah. So with maturity and the ability to build value over time, that value causes higher demand for talent, which means higher salaries for players, which means it spreads itself into the sponsorship costs for endemic sponsors, which are now seriously hitting pain points. The endemic companies, for the most part, you know, are peripheral companies that don't have a budget like, you know, some of the bigger non-endemic brands. And that's going to make it a squeeze play on the endemics to be able to. And then I think the key there is that they pick and choose their sponsorships extremely carefully and then drive to integrate their products on an operational level for pro esports. For the orgs, the non-endemics are the key to monetizing. And so here's the both sides of the sword here is that while esports has matured, it's still an immature, very loose and unstructured and undisciplined landscape. So the endemics look at it and they see this path to the millennials that they don't have. They can't get because they're cord cutters. They can't get it on traditional media. So it's attractive to them. But esports still has the what I call the NVIDIA moments that when some player or some luminary in the business, some influencer gets up and says something extremely out of place on social media, and it can even bring in their sponsors, and the horror of that for a brand manager is just unimaginable. So you have to look at the non-endemics, and they're looking at this with a very wary eye. You know, I applaud Turner and E-League for bringing in what do they have, Arby's and Snickers, two fantastic brands, I love the fun way that they kind of celebrated it and made it relevant to the audience without placating and or overplaying to them. I thought it was really well done and congratulate them. But still, the loose nature of esports just by nature delivers that risk to non-endemics. And that's I think, probably one of the largest blocking points for the orgs to really monetize.
I would agree with you. If you look at the influence that all this PewDiePie stuff on YouTube has had on the entire sponsorship landscape of YouTube. It just shows how volatile the state of those operations are, but also it shows the real gap between the true knowledge that these brands actually have of the influencer marketing tools that they're actually using. Another limitation on the brand's perspective is obviously going to be the titles themselves. So, you know, Counter-Strike is only going to fly for certain organizations. Not everyone's going to want to get down with very realistic violence of terrorists and police are getting bullseyed in the head with a sniper rifle. Everyone's going to get down with that. Awesome. So we have covered how the expectations have changed over the last few years. We like to focus on the solution to the problems as well, not just painting picture of something that's doom and gloom here. So how can endemic teams demonstrate their true value to brands in and outside of the space? And how can brands actually go beyond to provide extra value to these esports organizations?
Sure. Well, for both endemic and non-endemic brands, the pressure to raise the quality, production quality level around their social media and content production is real. I think the days of the quick cell phone picture satisfying the needs of a brand manager and the organization behind it are coming to an end. I think there's still those magic moments, and I'm not saying that they're gone, but I think that brands are going to require the orgs to provide curated content that meets brand guidelines and follows a certain storyline that delivers on their campaign and on their key objectives on their campaign. And that's critical, right? That the ability to go off track is just huge. So it requires working with the teams and the players themselves to understand not only the products and the market around it and the customers that and their fans who are buying these products, but understand the company behind it and the people, and be able to speak to the brand in a way that is organic to esports and it feels credible to the audience that's watching this, so that it's not avoiding the paid statement feel is one of the hardest things to do in capturing brand endorsements like that.
Yeah, one of the main points that I'll extend from that is I still think there's massive piece of education between the production quality that is already existing in esports. Like when I introduce friends and family to this, like they are always quite blown away by how strong it already is. And I guess brands as well will have their own standards that they bring to the table. But I do think that in terms of maximizing the value, whatever content that they actually bring out has to be emotionally engaged. It has to speak the message in the right way to really touch base with the consumers and fans of the space. It's a very interesting point. Do you think that teams do enough when they're looking at internally to actually raise up their own players? Because I feel like there are so few strong household names that are kind of transcendent of the standard esports noise. You know, like you have your double lifts that are super personable and overconfident. You've got your Recklesses as well. You've got your others in other sports like Olaf Meister in CSGO. How can these teams actually do better to raise up their own resources internally from their teams?
That's one of the things that the orgs and the teams can ask of their sponsors is pick one of the players who speaks well and use them for the anything kind of verbal, right? If so, a lot of the guys, you know, these guys are video game players, just like baseball and football players. They're not actors. And when they get them on screen, a lot of them are just really uncomfortable and it comes across as awkward. So to get the best delivery, it's extremely difficult. You could sit there and do 100 takes with the one guy that's having trouble with it, or you could find their best speaker, even if it's a coach. Right? You're still reaching these kids. They know who this guy is. The kids know their superstar level. The reason why Deion Sanders or Larry Bird or big brands of traditional sports was because they're on television. We're just not on television. Esports is not mass media. Kobe Bryant, who my mother knew, you know, my sister knows them, and they're not basketball fans. It's just, we're not there yet. And it's probably going to take 15 years, maybe 10 or 15 to get there. So they're going to have to make their own superstars, and they can work with their sponsors to do that. And the sponsors should love it because, now you have a motivated partner who's also getting something out of the deal. And being able to co-market in that way and help that sponsor get the most out of their dollars that they spend with you is really a super fantastic way to not only build on your partnership, but be able to retain it throughout the years, which is the goal, right? If you're swapping up brand partners every couple of years, something's wrong. You know, you want to keep those guys. You want to build that thing into something huge.
Sure. And I 100% agree. When I was at the Leaders in Sport event recently, there was a presentation between Microsoft, HP, and Nielsen that were on stage, and they were speaking about how can brands and esports organizations actually partner together. There was a really interesting promo that Microsoft have done with Astralis, where they basically do a very short clip on one of their players' device, and they show his regular routine throughout the day. And honestly, 100% of the time, you could see him slotting in with any other sport so easily. You know, he's running as the sun comes up. He's putting in his hours on the training side. He's smashing it with all the fans. He's being the utmost professional. And it's going to be great to see more opportunities for these players to step out and actually break some of the stereotypes. Like, being inside the industry, it's very, you know, easier for us to believe that not everyone who's an esports fan is a Cheeto-fingered nerd who sits in a basement. there's a lot wider spectrum and much further reach for esports in age groups and social stratifications that those that are outside the industry might not really be able to make assumptions on. You know, like the average esports fan who's commercially active is a lot older than your sporty teenager. You know, as some of the esports fans actually watch some of the highest amounts of content are actually in their late 20s, early 30s. So there's a lot more space for these players to be disruptive and also use their personalities to maximize their time in the spotlight. We've just got one more point, James, and then unfortunately we've got to shut down the show for this episode. But I want to ask you this. How can brands integrate with live events and the events producers themselves, like the ESL, like DreamHack, like the upcoming Overwatch League? How can endemic brands and non-endemic brands better integrate with these events other than just flashing their logo everywhere? What are the kind of smarter, more intuitive things that they can be getting up to?
Well, for the endemic brands, they don't normally have opportunities to do event marketing at an arena event, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Esports provides that theater for them to show off their brand. And one thing I have yet to see from the endemics anyway, not the non-endemics, is they do this stuff all the time, right? They're at all the big trade shows and all the big consumer events. So they're used to doing this stuff on a grand scale. The endemics don't necessarily have that. But to bring in some of the ideas that non-endemics do, like when I was with the Beach Boys, we had sponsorships by Sunkist, Orange Sodas, and Chevrolet. Every day before the concert, one of the first guy off the bus was the guy with the Sunkist inflatable, super big inflatable. Goes it out, puts it on each side of the stage, and you cannot miss it, right? There are things that are bigger than life that are ways to get your brand out front that are maybe not mainstream for an endemic brand. And those are interesting ways to get noticed. The other thing that I think is important is no matter what kind of product you do, strive to get it integrated in an operational level and let the world know about it, that you are an integral part within the ecosystem of the professional esports world. And, you know, I think that's critical for endemic brands, whether it's through your partners of the players and teams, or if you're partnering with a tournament operator, look for those opportunities to get that stuff on camera in product placement, and then tell the world about it and talk about it and put it in your annual report. There's a lot of things that people aren't doing with the facts and figures of their activities in esports that don't get told, and you know the financial world's watching. Take advantage of it from all the way from your creative concept through execution, through telling the world about it in your annual report. Take advantage of that.
So what are a few examples of this in practice? You know, we're starting to see certain moments in the game being sponsored by a brand. So we've had like the Intel highlights, or, you know, you've got the replays in the UFC being sponsored by Bud Light. Yes, listeners, I do watch the UFC. Obviously, I mention it pretty much every episode. So sorry that all of my examples are so fighting specific. It's just more like I see how well those guys are able almost over-commercialize every single moment on screen. And esports just doesn't really do that at all. Now, I don't want it to become like baseball when you've got almost the same amount of content between each round or set or whatever you call it when they switch sides on the pitch. But there is a lot more space for those kind of smart integrated moments like you've already mentioned to be brought in.
Well, I think for the non-endemics, they have the benefit of having a little more open rein to have fun with it. And if you saw the Arby's commercials on E-League, that's an example. They were having fun with it. They were using relevance to Counter-Strike itself, right? They were tie-ins. It was humorous. And I think that, you know, the millennials, that age group is a skeptical group. And if you come in with a traditional message selling insurance, you're going to get shut down. They're going to you're going to sponsor the bathroom break for the audience. Yeah. Right. So I think that's critical. And, you know, not to poke fun at insurance companies, because I think what Geico has done, their work around esports is pretty fascinating. And, you know, these guys need car insurance. Lord knows they need health insurance. There's a customer base there that is existent, and this is a fantastic method to reach them. So I think you're going to see non-endemic growth in a big way this year. I think I saw a report in the news yesterday that there's been some big progress. I expect that trend to continue. And as you know, like I think the Overwatch League and the BAMTech guys getting involved with League of Legends broadcasting is all going to add structure and guidelines for to protect non-endemic brands from the Reddit moments.
Yeah.
Right. And to have a structure for player behaviors and to so that they have something to go from, because kids haven't had that guidance in the past, and they need some help. So having the major league sports involved is just a massive benefit. And so I really welcome those dollars as they come in for team investments, and hope to see them on the non-endemic sponsor side as well.
I think that's why the what can we do for brands piece is such a major issue at the moment, because there's going to be a settling of the waters once these franchise models start to come in. Obviously, year on year, everyone's going to learn how they can improve their projects and their operations with those opportunities. But we're going to really start to see two amazingly strong propositions where brands will be able to get much more involved in a more structured manner. So it's just really exciting, and I can see why it's on the top of most people's minds at the moment. So yeah, let's keep our fingers and toes crossed for the future. James, it's been awesome to have you on. I've got one more piece for you.
Sure.
Which is our fun recurring segment, which is going to be called Back to the Future for this week. If you could have any pro-facing role in esports from a title past, present, future, or fantasy, what would it be and why?
Wow.
We've had mascots, we've had football manager analysts, we've had pre-game personalities, we've had some serious ones, but we've had some ridiculous ones.
Boy.
Where are you leaning towards?
Well, I would say I want to be the guy that redesigns the Twitch interface for streaming video games. In 5 years, okay, we're going to look back at it, and that video quality and that chat window on a big title when there's 800 million kids on there, and that it's going by at lightning speed. What were they thinking, right?
Thanks. Yeah, that's absolutely great. So, James, thank you very much for leaping on the show. Where can people find you if they want to reach out?
My email is jamesgrunke@gmail.com, and I am james-grunke on LinkedIn.
Awesome. We are coming up fast to our 10th episode of the Roundtable. Hopefully, we're going to be doing something a little bit special for that one. But in the meantime, every single rating and review on iTunes means the world to us. So if you could spare just 1 or 2 minutes of your time, slip over to iTunes, let us know what you thought. Would really appreciate you guys stopping by and helping us out. James, really appreciate the time, and everyone else, we will speak to you soon.